sometimes came without my conscious effort. Instead, that new gulf between myself and my urges meant that they no longer had the ability to make me depressed. This step also involved giving up the idea that I had to figure anything out. I no longer attempted to determine the deep psychological reasons for an urge. I didn't try to find out what triggered my automatic thoughts and feelings. I didn't try to solve any of my other problems to make the urge go away. And I didn't seek out other forms of emotional nourishment in an attempt to suppress the urges. I simply let the urge be, without getting caught up in it. The ability to stop reacting emotionally to urges flowed naturally from my new knowledge that the urges were separate from my highest human brain. In other words, step 3 flowed naturally from step 2. In turn, step 4 flowed naturally from step 3, and step 4 was the cure for my bulimia. Chapter 27. Brain Over Binge Step 4. Stop Acting on Urges to Binge. Not only did separating myself from my urges give me the power to stop reacting emotionally to them, more importantly, it gave me the capacity to stop acting on them. This fourth step defined my recovery, because once I stopped acting on my urges to binge, I was no longer bulimic. I was cured. I finally realized that I had the ability to stop putting too much food in my mouth, and I felt powerfully that my actions were not out of my control. My brain, my neurons, my habit couldn't make me do anything. I could finally hear my faulty brain activity for the farce that it really was, and it became relatively easy not to act. My recovery was nothing more than learning to say no. I didn't have to substitute any other activity for those inappropriate motor actions my lower brain had me doing in the past, like standing by an open refrigerator putting too much food in my mouth, or driving to fast food places and gas stations to waste money on binge food. I didn't have to distract myself with a hobby, physical work, phone calls, or journaling. I didn't have to do anything productive. I didn't have to find a way to meet my emotional needs. I just went about my day as if I were not experiencing an urge to binge. And sometimes, if I had nothing else to do, I just sat or lay down to listen to my brain with detachment. I actually came to enjoy hearing thoughts and feelings that encouraged me to binge without acting on them, because it gave me a great sense of power. I liked to simply listen to those urges with complete detachment. I often thought back to the days when those urges had controlled me, and I reveled in the fact that I was back in the driver's seat. I loved that I could trust myself again. It wasn't a struggle for me to not act on my urges. Sometimes it wasn't an enjoyable experience either, but it was never a fight. When I was first getting used to viewing my urges as not really me, there were a few times when I doubted my ability not to act on them. When I temporarily lost the separation of my highest human brain from my urges. If I started thinking it was really me who wanted to binge, I could get wrapped up in my cravings, and this is why I binged one more time after making my commitment to quit. After my slip, I was able to look back and see when I had stopped listening as a detached observer of my lower brain and had started relating to my cravings. I saw that I had simply failed to put brain over binge, and thus had been swept away by a wave of faulty neural activity. I was even more determined not to let it happen again. Why the urges went away. My urges to binge tapered off quickly after I stopped acting on them. In Rational Recovery, Jack Trimpe says this will happen. He writes that the voice encouraging use of the addictive substance will fall silent if it is ignored. However, I still wondered, why did this happen? How did my urges simply disappear? Is my bulimia merely hiding out somewhere in my brain, waiting to take control again? Jeffrey Schwartz's OCD study, discussed earlier, finally gave me an answer to these questions. Schwartz's work explained why my urges to binge had disappeared and taught me that my bulimia was certainly not waiting to take control again. By avoiding acting on my urges to binge, I had physically changed my brain so that my bulimia no longer existed. By teaching his patients to use mindfulness and think differently about their urges, Schwartz gave them the power to turn attention away from the urges, stop acting on them, and improve their OCD behaviors. What is more, he found evidence that these improvements were accompanied by real, measurable physical changes in their brains. When the treatment began, the pathological brain circuitry of the OCD patients dominated, and they were submitting to their OCD urges. However, over the course of several weeks, as they changed the way they thought about their thoughts, they were able to produce systematic changes in the very neural systems that generate those pathological messages. The result was not only a change in their behavior, but also a dampening of metabolic activity in the regions of the brain those previous overactivity caused the OCD symptoms. Schwartz gave his patients what he called an avenue to self-directed neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity, as you will recall, is the ability of the brain to physically change based on our thoughts, experiences, and actions. Thus, the patient's willful choices not to act on their urges fed back into their brains, creating the physical changes that made the choices subsequently easier and easier. Schwartz says, though OCD symptoms may be generated passively by the brain, the choice of whether to view those symptoms as me or OCD, whether to become ensnared by them or focus on a non-pathological behavior is active. The choice is generated by a patient's mind, and it changes the brain. This was the first study of its kind to show that therapy without drugs can change faulty brain chemistry. Indeed, the changes Schwartz identified in the OCD patients' PET scans were the kind that neuropsychiatrists might see in patients being treated with powerful mind-altering drugs. I believe that, just like Schwartz's OCD patients, my mind, my true self, changed my brain. My highest human brain vetoed each and every urge, and in doing so, I rewired my lower brain. My lower brain learned that I no longer binged, and it therefore stopped urging me to do so. Again, when it comes to the brain that you no longer use, you lose. Once the neural connections that fueled my binge-created brain-wiring problem were no longer useful, my brain weakened them and pruned them. In other words, when I put brain over binge, my bulimia was over. Chapter 28, Brain Over Binge, Step 5, Get Excited. Step 5 was a bonus. It was a natural result of resisting my urges to binge, but little did I know it actually served to speed along my brain changes. Praise from others or within, and enthusiasm for learning something new, cement that learning on a physical level in the brain. This is why we all naturally praise babies and children for their small feats. It not only makes them feel good, but it has a physical effect on their brains, making those accomplishments easier for a child to repeat in the future. It is the same with adults. In short, celebrating a new discovery increases the likelihood that it will be remembered. I got excited every time I had thoughts and feelings encouraging me to binge and didn't act on them. Every time I felt a craving without letting it lead me to the refrigerator. Every time I had powerful urges to binge, but remained detached and unaffected by them. I was really excited. My urges had consumed me for years, and all of a sudden, I had power over them. It felt as though I had been granted a brand new life, even though nothing changed except my binge eating. What I didn't know was that every time I got excited, I was focusing positive attention on my highest human brain's accomplishment. Since brain functions that are given attention and significance strengthen, and brain functions that are not given attention and significance weaken, it only makes sense that this would have sped along my brain changes. Focusing on the power of my highest human brain and congratulating myself for it served to strengthen new connections in the prefrontal parts of my brain and weaken the old ones in the automatic lower parts of my brain. No, I do not have scientific proof of my brain changes as Schwartz had with his OCD patients. I do not have a PET scan of my brain before and after my recovery to illustrate exactly where and how these physical changes occurred. What I do have as evidence is my experience. I no longer have urges to binge. Thoughts, feelings, and urges don't arise out of nothing. Every moment of our experience is the result of neural activity, and unless electrical signals from neurons fire across synapses, we don't experience sensations. Since all sensations encouraging me to binge, all the thoughts, feelings, and urges disappeared completely, I can only conclude it's because the neurons that once fired their electrical signals to produce those thoughts, feelings, and urges are no longer firing. My self-directed neuroplasticity, as Schwartz labeled it in his OCD patients, was a real biological cure for my bulimia. My eating disorder is no longer wired into my brain. This doesn't mean I will never have an urge to binge in the future because, as I'll discuss in the next chapter, it is possible for neurons to remember old patterns of activity. However, if my lower brain sends out an urge in the future, I will know exactly what to do. I will listen to it with detachment, and I won't react emotionally to it or act on it. Then my habit can never develop again. Chapter 29. Is relapse a possibility? My urges to binge were the one and only cause of my binge eating, and my urges to binge are gone. Therefore, I won't binge again. Due to my brain changes, it's doubtful that I'll ever feel an urge to binge again. However, it's certainly possible. I'm sure my lower brain remembers my past at some level and remains capable of producing urges, but that doesn't mean I'm at risk for relapse. In order to relapse, I would have to not only experience an urge to binge, but choose to act on it. The cause of a relapse is the same as the cause of any binge eating episode, an urge to binge. Now that I know that my urges are the real problem, and now that I know how to deal with those urges, I have foolproof protection against relapse. To prevent relapse, all I have to do is never act on an urge to binge, ever. Granted, if I did act on urges to binge one day, I could probably redevelop the habit of bulimia rather quickly, just as an out-of-practice musician can begin to play much more easily than someone who has never played. I could probably reestablish my binge-created brain-wiring problem easier than someone who has never had bulimia. But to develop my habit again, I would have to choose to. My brain cannot reestablish old patterns of neural activity unless I willingly take action. But why would I do that? Now that I have tasted freedom from my urges and compulsions, there is simply no chance that I would ever binge again. Now that I know my binge eating was never a way of coping with life, I will never let difficult life events turn into excuses for binge eating. Now that I know binge eating wasn't a symbolic way of fulfilling emotional needs, I will not delude myself into thinking I could find comfort in binge eating. Relapse in traditional therapy. Relapse after treatment is relatively common. One study found a 35% relapse rate for bulimia. In traditional therapy, relapse is often blamed on the failure of the patient to recognize and confront any underlying issue. The supposed reason for relapse often depends on which type of therapy is being used. For example, in psychodynamic therapy, relapse could potentially happen if the patient does not fully deal with shame from prior sexual abuse and she binges to stuff down those shameful feelings that she can't deal with. From the perspective of cognitive behavioral therapy, relapse could happen if the patient's self-esteem is still shaky. If she fails in some way, such as getting fired from a job or stood up on a date, she could feel terrible about herself and binge to escape feelings of worthlessness. In addiction treatment, relapse could happen if the patient eats one of the foods she is supposedly powerless against, such as a piece of cake or something else containing white sugar. In all of these examples, relapse supposedly happens because of an outside event or an inner conflict. Relapse is something that happens to you in traditional therapy, not something you bring upon yourself, not something you choose. This type of thinking only promotes relapse. The truth is, relapse doesn't happen because of inner emotional turmoil, stressful life events, or eating a piece of cake. Relapse is a choice. I've been through plenty of hard times since I recovered, and not once did I consider binge eating. I've also been through plenty of happy times since then, and not once did I consider binge eating. Because I separated my bulimia from my other problems and all life events. Nothing causes me to contemplate binge eating. My eating disorder will not spring up again, catching me off guard, throwing me into the abyss of uncontrollable binging and purging. If one day I happen to hear an old thought or an old feeling encouraging me to binge eat, I can say, "No thanks, brain, I don't binge anymore," and then go about my day. It won't matter when the urge occurs, it won't matter what I'm feeling at the time, and it won't matter what problems I may be dealing with. I simply won't act on it. Another insurance I have against relapse is that the factors that originally caused my urges to binge when I was a teenager, dieting, strong survival instincts, and incomplete development of my prefrontal cortex, no longer exist. I don't diet anymore, and even if I did, my survival instincts would not be as strong as they were when I was younger. Furthermore, if I did choose to diet, my prefrontal cortex would be better able to override those survival instincts because it's now fully developed. Dieting simply wouldn't cause the same biological havoc in me that it did when I was 16. I will talk much more about dieting and eating normally in chapters 31 and 32. The bottom line is, nothing can make me relapse besides free choice. Not survival instincts, not neurological remnants of my old habit, not life stress, not character flaws, not emotional issues. Now that I know what my bulimia was all about and how I was able to recover, I am free to move on with my life, knowing that I will never again become bulimic. Chapter 30. Where I am today. In therapy, I often feared recovery because I worried about what was to come after my bulimia ended. I thought I had to be something great after recovery, fulfilled, confident, successful, spiritual, and capable of dealing with anything life threw my way. My lower brain often used this idea to create excuses to binge. On days when I didn't binge, yet still had a bad day for reasons wholly unrelated to eating, I heard thoughts like these. I didn't binge, and my day wasn't any better than if I had, so what's the point of quitting? I'll never amount to anything, so I might as well keep binge eating. Life is too hard anyway, so there isn't any reason to recover. Looking back over my old journals, I see multiple lists of reasons to recover, containing lofty ambitions like, I can fully give myself to someone else, be in love. I can find a fulfilling career. I can live peacefully in the moment. I can be confident and fully accept myself and my body. However, no amount of envisioning my transformation could convince my lower brain that recovery was better than binge eating. Eventually, I had to accept that I needed to recover, whether or not I'd be better off afterward. I had to do as rational recovery suggested and simply quit my addiction, now and for good, and let the chips fall where they may. Turns out, my life is much better after recovery, but not because I'm always happy or fulfilled, and not because I've accomplished spectacular things. My life is better simply because I stopped a shameful, time-consuming, expensive, health-sabotaging, and life-draining habit. I haven't binged in over 5 years, and my life is not perfect by far. It certainly isn't the recovery I envisioned in my journals. I can't tell you that I'm emotionally and spiritually fulfilled or completely happy in every aspect of my life. I can't tell you I eat a perfectly healthy and balanced diet, keep a consistent exercise routine, and love my body, because that would be pure exaggeration. My recovery was not the butterfly tale I talked about at the start of this book, but I can say that stopping my bulimia has brought me a long way toward becoming the person I want to be. Stopping my habit has given me more confidence, more strength, and most importantly, more control over my life than I ever could have imagined just a handful of years ago. I am thankful every day that I no longer binge and no longer have to spend my days at the gym. I am also thankful that I don't have to work on my recovery one day at a time. My recovery is over, and there is nothing I have to do to maintain it. No meal plans, no support groups, no counseling to cope with life to prevent me from returning to binge eating. Stopping my habit has given me the chance to have a real life. I have a wonderful husband and beautiful and loving children who keep me laughing, very busy, and often very tired. The possibility of becoming a mother seemed unfeasible during the years I was bulimic, because I was so caught up in my own problems that I couldn't give much to anyone else. Now, although I struggle with the everyday stress of being a parent, I am able to care for my family without my disorder draining my energy, my time, and my spirit. I am able to pursue goals, nurture relationships, and simply perform my daily activities as a stay-at-home mom without constantly having to worry about whether or not I will binge. Life isn't easy, and if I still believe I binge to cope, I could find lots of excuses in my life. I feel quite alone raising our children much of the time, as my family and Greg's family live far away and Greg's work takes up a great deal of his time. I miss my parents, my sister, who I've become very close to again as we've entered motherhood, and her children, but right now living near them is not possible. I feel a great deal of anxiety in my home because we live in a high crime area, and I don't have many friends where we live. Granted, these are rather ordinary problems, but I'm sure if I were still bulimic, my lower brain could find lots of poor me stories to tempt me to binge. One of the more difficult things that happened to me came only a few months after I stopped binge eating. My childhood home, which my parents still lived in at the time, was destroyed by Hurricane Katrina. Of course, the most important thing was that my parents were all right, because ultimately material things can be replaced. Still, it was a difficult time for us, and many of my family members and friends who lived in New Orleans had lost so much. However, it was very different to experience a major life event without it having any implications on bulimia. There was nothing special I had to do to cope with the crisis to prevent binge eating, because my binge eating was over. I simply coped the best way I knew how. A week after the storm, Greg and I requested leave from work, loaded up our cars with supplies, and drove 1,500 miles across the country to help my parents. In my bulimic days, this would have been a very dangerous situation, in that when we were in Louisiana, we didn't know where our next meal would come from, and we didn't have much control over what we ate. A local charity organization provided food for our community, and there was no choice in what was served and when it was served. Prior to quitting, this would have caused me a lot of stress. But after recovery, I was able to accept whatever food was given with nothing but gratitude. My parents had about 6 feet of water in their one-story house, so we had to throw out just about everything. It was a surreal feeling to see all the things I'd grown up with in a huge, wet, dirty pile in our front yard. I saw the pain on my parents' faces as we worked, knowing how much effort and love they had put into their house over the years. I didn't quite know what to say, so I quietly carried load after load of moldy drywall out of the house in a wheelbarrow and dumped it on the pile. At one point, my dad and Greg had to cut a hole in a kitchen wall to remove the refrigerator, one I had binged from countless times. As they lowered it into the garage, it began to leak, and there is nothing I could say that would accurately describe the horrible odor that came from it. They quickly put it down, and we all ran as far away from the house as possible to escape the smell. As I looked at the refrigerator in the garage, I thought about how I once thought the food in it was laden with symbolic meaning in my life. I once believed it held my emotions, my pain, my inadequacies, our family conflicts. And now its contents were spilling out on the ground in a putrid mess. I could finally see the food for what it was. Just food. Nothing more. Nothing less. I might have had an urge to binge while I was helping with cleanup efforts in Louisiana, but honestly, I don't really remember because other memories of that time are much more prominent. If I did experience any remnants of my binge-created brainwiring problem, I was able to ignore them and perform the work at hand. As Greg and I drove back to Phoenix, we traveled the same route that my dad and I had taken when I first moved there a year and a half prior. I remembered while on that drive with my dad, I had been anxious about binge eating and wondering how I would ever recover. Now I was traveling the same road and fully recovered, even if the urges to binge hadn't fully tapered off yet. The drive this time was much more like when I drove to meet Greg while I was on Topamax, in that I may have had other problems and life may have been difficult, but I was suddenly free to other possibilities. This time my freedom was all of my own making. I didn't know the full extent of it at the time, but by taking control and changing my behavior, I was physically changing my brain, erasing the very neural pathways that had kept me trapped for so long. I was becoming normal again, flaws and all. In the next section, I'll explain a little more about what my life is like today as I address topics often discussed in traditional therapy, like self-esteem, poor body image, coping with problems and triggers. By talking about these topics and things like purging, medication, and prevention, I hope to present a new view of these issues that is more conducive to recovery. Part 3. Therapy Concepts Reexamined. Chapter 31. Normal Eating. The tricky thing about bulimia was I could stop binge eating, but I couldn't stop eating. It wasn't like breaking the habit of a drug or alcohol addiction where one can just avoid a substance completely. I needed to eat to live, but I needed to learn to eat normally. And unfortunately, there is no easy answer to the question of how to eat normally. Everyone has different needs, different tastes, different likes and dislikes, different metabolisms, different activity levels, and different needs to lose or gain weight. Furthermore, the question of how to eat normally is not specific to those with a history of eating disorders. Everyone faces the challenges of making food choices, listening to the needs of the body, and trying to eat optimally based on their goals. When I first quit binge eating, I defined normal eating in general terms. Normal eating meant I did not binge, and I did not diet restrictively. I knew my eating habits should ideally meet all of my nutritional needs, make me feel healthy, allow me to maintain a healthy weight, yet be pleasurable, and allow for some indulgences. My only real goal at that point, however, was to stop binge eating, not to have a perfect diet. I told myself that once I got over my habit, I would work on perfecting my diet. But to this day, I still don't have what I would consider a perfect diet. I eat when I'm hungry and stop when I'm full, although not 100% of the time. I eat a little too much at meals occasionally, and sometimes I don't eat enough because I'm too busy to sit down for a meal. I like desserts, and I probably eat a little too much sugar in processed foods. However, my imperfect diet is not a signal that my eating disorder is not over. I've learned over the years that no one eats perfectly. All that matters is that I am generally satisfied with my eating habits because I now have the freedom to eat what I want, when I want, and yet I never take it to the extreme, meaning I never binge or diet. I enjoy eating healthy food and exercising, and I strive to maintain good nutritional habits. I am not that different. My recovery did not involve establishing a healthy eating plan and sticking to it, attaining and maintaining my ideal weight, being able to eat any type of food without worrying about weight gain, or even avoiding all overeating, because those things are not specific to bulimia. Recovery taught me a simple fact when it came to my diet and many other topics I often talked about in therapy. I am not that different. It was a misfortune that I learned in therapy to set myself apart from the rest of the population. I got the message that I couldn't just eat like everyone else. Those who recover with traditional therapy often follow meal plans indefinitely, thinking that those plans will somehow keep the bulimia from coming back. However, after I recovered, I realized I could simply resume eating like other people. This doesn't mean I haven't had food challenges since recovery. It only means that the challenges I faced are similar to those that everyone else faces every day. Everyone, not just those with eating disorders, has to decide what to eat for meals and snacks, assess their body's hunger and fullness signals, and decide whether or not to overindulge in favorite foods. Many people worry that certain food will make them gain weight. In fact, it seems as though most of the U.S. population has some sort of food issue. I'm not saying the prevalence of hang-ups about eating should be an acceptable thing in our culture. However, less than healthy eating habits and attitudes do not define an eating disorder. When I was in therapy, I often looked at some of my friends, coworkers, and family members with curiosity, wondering how it was that they didn't have eating disorders, when it seemed obvious to me that they had many food issues. A couple of my coworkers talked endlessly about their diets, what they'd had for lunch, how many calories they'd burned during their last workout, how much weight they'd gained or lost. Some of my friends frequently turned down desserts, fast food, and foods high in carbohydrates because they were trying to lose weight. Others lamented about eating too much at a meal or special occasion. Some of my family members were much more fervent about running than I ever was during my days of anorexia. It often made me angry that other people could have what I thought were eating disorder symptoms, yet still considered normal. Why was I singled out as the one with the eating disorder when everywhere I looked, other people had all kinds of food issues? After I recovered and returned to the world of normal eaters, I realized that the spectrum of normal is so wide that it was foolish of me to think that many of those I knew had eating disorders. They might have had some food hang-ups, but they were normal nonetheless. Some people simply choose to place a high emphasis on appearance and spend a lot of time trying to get or maintain an ideal body without it being a problem for them. This is not a lifestyle choice I personally agree with, but I'm not going to condemn others for it or call them eating disordered. Therapy gave too much significance to what, when, and how I ate and the feelings surrounding eating. In therapy, it was as if I wrapped up every food issue I had in a box and stamped it bulimia, when in fact, binge eating and purging were the only food issues that should have been in that box. The advice I gave to myself after I stopped binge eating is the same advice that I would give to anyone with any type of food issue. If the food issues I have don't affect my life negatively, I don't need to address them. But if my food hang-ups do affect my life negatively, I should change them. Indeed, I have changed some of my eating habits for the better. Without binge eating getting in the way, I am now able to see the amazing health benefits food can have. For instance, I rid my diet of an overabundance of artificially sweetened low-calorie foods. For years during my eating disorder, I thought low-calorie soda, cookies, yogurt, and candy were good for me just because they were diet food. I often chose those options over things I considered too fattening, like avocados and nuts, which are in fact extremely healthy, even if high in calories. Today I would much rather munch down a large serving of almonds for a snack than eat a few artificially sweetened cookies. I'm not saying I'd always refuse a diet snack, but if I do choose to eat one on a rare occasion, I'm no longer deceived into thinking it's always healthy. Another food issue I changed was my tendency to always accept desserts when it was offered to me, even if I truly didn't want it. Now, if I have no desire for a dessert, I simply say no. I've also stopped comparing what I eat to what others eat, especially other women. I have a high metabolism, so I can eat and need to eat more food than the average woman. I've also become very decisive about what I'm going to eat. I used to deliberate for a long time when looking at menus or deciding what to fix myself for meals. Now I just choose something quickly, remembering that it's just one meal and it doesn't have to be perfect, and then get on with the business of living. These simple improvements just increased my quality of life. They were not a part of recovery or relapse prevention. I hope to make even more improvements to my eating habits in the future. I have a vision of myself eating primarily whole organic foods, enjoying cooking and eating to fully and completely nourish every cell in my body and ward off disease. Because food is truly an amazing thing when considering all of the health benefits of eating optimally. Right now, due to time and financial constraints, not to mention lack of cooking skills, I don't come close to that ideal, but I'm doing my best until circumstances will allow me to do better. Until then, I take some supplements to try to reap the benefits that may be lacking from my regular diet. Surprise! I didn't lose touch with my appetite. When I was caught up in binge eating and purging, it was hard to fathom simply eating normally. I felt I'd lost touch with my fullness and hunger signals because I'd plowed through the fullness signals so many times while binging and ignored the hunger signals so many times while purging. I felt I'd never be able to control myself around food. I thought I would never be able to just eat and not worry much about it. But after I stopped binge eating, I realized that I hadn't lost touch after all. I already knew how to eat normally, even though I hadn't done it in a long time. I also knew what normal eating looked like because I'd spent years watching other people eat, often critiquing their eating habits. Furthermore, I was highly educated about healthy diets, and I had followed plenty of nutritionist-approved meal plans over the years. My bulimia most likely did alter my hunger and satiety mechanisms to some extent, but it didn't take long for those signals to re-regulate themselves. In the weeks and months after I quit binge eating, I just ate normally, day after day, based on my understanding of normal eating, and my body and brain adjusted quickly. Soon, eating normally based on levels of hunger and fullness became effortless. Brain power. I found that it was not useful to worry much about my diet in the weeks and months after my recovery. I ate what worked for me, and I ate what I liked. I just didn't listen to my lower brain when it urged me to binge. I believe that my lack of focus on my diet during that period was tremendously helpful in that it turned my attention away from food. I was devoting less brain power for food and eating, and not obsessing about it showed my lower brain that food and eating didn't need to be assigned so much significance. As explained in Chapter 25, this lack of attention allowed my brain to weaken the neural connections that kept me focused on food. Even though I tried not to worry so much about food after I quit binge eating, what and how much I ate sometimes caused my brain to react automatically. My lower brain sometimes acted up when I ate too much, too little, or even when I ate certain types of food. I found that there were three main eating situations that caused these reactions. 1. Urges to binge arose when I overate. When I first stopped binge eating, my lower brain definitely acted up when I overate. This only made sense. Overeating had led me to binge in the past, so my lower brain had learned an association or pattern. Since that was what was currently programmed in my brain, that's what I had to live with until it learned otherwise. For example, if I ate a little too much at a restaurant, I sometimes experienced a conditioned response. Automatic thoughts arose such as, "You overdid it. This is proof that you can't control yourself around food. You might as well binge now and start over tomorrow." And I sometimes began to feel a craving to binge. I tried not to let this catch me off guard. I learned to expect my lower brain to act up when I ate a bit too much, and I always reminded myself that overeating was not the problem. It was never the cause of my binge eating. Besides, it wasn't realistic to think that I'd go through life never indulging a little too much in pleasurable foods. Everyone overeats from time to time. It didn't take long for my lower brain to stop producing urges when I was full. Then I was able to eat an extra piece of cake or another helping of a delicious dinner with confidence that it wouldn't get out of hand. Obviously, I'm not saying that overeating is actually a goal of mine, but although I aim to eat healthy portions as often as possible, I do enjoy having the freedom to indulge every now and then. I like being able to eat a big holiday meal without worrying that I'll polish off the leftovers after the guests go home. It's actually nice to feel a little too full once in a while. 2. Urges to binge arose when I underate. I also found that my lower brain generated urges to binge when I ate too little or when I chose low-calorie foods. Again, this was my brain's automatic conditioned response. By dieting, I'd made my lower brain hypersensitive to food shortages so that it became particularly resistant to any form of dieting. Even though I had not dieted in a long time, my survival instincts were still on heightened alert. And furthermore, since I often binged soon after undereating, my lower brain had learned that undereating leads to binge eating. So it automatically produced urges to binge whenever there was a hint of food restriction. I was well aware that food restriction caused this brain reaction. Until some time went by, and my lower brain learned that there was no longer a threat of starvation and that I no longer binged after undereating, I had to deal with this. This is not to say I allowed myself to eat anything and everything in order to prevent my body from feeling deprived. That would not have been healthy, and it also would not have been dealing with the real problem, the urges to binge. For example, let's say I went to dinner at a restaurant and really wanted a hamburger, but instead ordered a salad because I had eaten a lot for lunch. As I ate the salad, I began having an urge to binge, and my lower brain generated thoughts of all the food I could eat when I got home. I felt automatic feelings of resentment for the salad, longing for more fattening foods. It wasn't the salad's fault that I had the urge to binge, and it wasn't my fault for ordering the salad, because I really thought it was the best choice. But my decision to have salad didn't mean I was then destined to binge, because what I did or did not eat was never the cause of binge eating. In the weeks and months after I stopped binge eating, what I did or didn't eat could certainly trigger urges to binge. During my years of therapy, I was in for a real mess every time I tried to sit down for a meal. Because therapy had taught me that what I ate or didn't eat was the problem, I had to constantly ask myself, what food is the least likely to cause binge eating? I had to try to pick meals that weren't too excessive, weren't too restrictive, didn't contain any binge foods, and didn't contain much sugar. Even so, there were no guarantees against binge eating. But once I learned that the urges to binge were the real problem and learned to deal with those urges, I discovered that deliberating over every decision regarding food wasn't necessary. I stopped having to worry about what I would order at a restaurant. I could order what I wanted, or even what I thought I should eat, as in the salad example, and if it ended up producing an urge to binge, that was no big deal. I simply put brain over binge, ate the food I ordered, and refused to be bothered by my lower brain's pesky responses. Just as nearly everyone overeats from time to time, nearly everyone undereats from time to time too. When I was in therapy, I used to marvel at normal people who would make comments like, "I'm starving, I haven't had a thing to eat all day," or, "I didn't have time for lunch today," or, "I had to rush out of the house and didn't get breakfast." This seemed unfathomable to me because I was so used to trying to follow meal plans and making sure I never got too hungry or too full. Today, I find myself saying those same unfathomable things. I certainly didn't try to skip meals, but if it happens, it's not a problem. My occasional undereating no longer leads to urges to binge. After I first quit binge eating, I sometimes decided I hadn't eaten enough, and I would seek out more food in normal amounts. For instance, in the situation where I ordered a salad and then had an urge to binge, I might have realized that the salad had not satisfied my physical needs. Ignoring my urges to binge did not mean I ignored my brain's normal hunger signals as well. After eating the salad, I'd know that the next time I went to dinner, it would be better for me to eat something more filling, not in an effort to prevent binge eating, but in order to meet my physical needs. But what would I do right after eating the salad and leaving the restaurant? Prior to recovering, I probably would have been swept away physically and emotionally by the urge to binge, and I would have sped home or to the nearest fast food restaurant and commenced a binge. After I recovered, that was simply not an option because I no longer acted on my urges, and I knew I didn't need to binge. So instead of acting irrationally based on automatic messages in my lower brain, I simply left the restaurant and ate a little more, rationally, with my highest human brain in the driver's seat. For example, I might have had one bowl of cereal when I got home, despite the fact that my lower brain was urging me to eat many more bowls. Eating rationally to meet my physical needs did not magically take my urges to binge away. But it did help send my brain a message that food was not in short supply. I believe that my effort not to undereat in the months after I quit binge eating helped my brain tame my survival instincts, and therefore made my urges to binge vanish more quickly. 3. Urges to binge arose when I ate my most pleasurable or former binge foods. It only made sense that eating a food I used to binge on sometimes created an urge to binge. For example, I used to eat dozens of cookies at a time during a binge. So after I stopped binge eating, eating a few cookies sometimes generated an urge to binge. Cookies are high in sugar and fat and very palatable. They were prime targets for my survival instinct-driven binges, so binging on cookies became a habit. If I had been unaware of what was going on in my lower brain, as I was prior to recovering, it would have been easy to think that the cookies were to blame and that I could not control myself around my former binge foods. However, knowing that the urges were the real problem and knowing how to deal with them allowed me to eat any former binge food that I wanted. By repeatedly binging on sweet and fattening foods in the past, I had created a pattern in my brain known as a stimulus response pattern, which I will talk about more in Chapter 35. Whenever I encountered the stimulus, cookies in this example, my lower brain automatically generated a response, an urge to binge. This happened only because I had taught my lower brain that cookies equaled binge eating. Temporarily, after I quit, I had to deal with the automatic urges to binge that sometimes arose when I ate former binge foods, knowing that no food could propel me to binge against my will. There was nothing wrong with a little indulgence in former binge foods. If eating a certain food created an urge, I simply separated myself from it, didn't react emotionally, and didn't act on it. As I ate my former binge foods time and time again without binge eating, I broke my brain's stimulus response patterns. Because I allowed myself to eat former binge foods in moderation, I was able to quickly break those patterns. While in therapy, I often tried to eat binge foods in moderation, but with little success. I believe that was troublesome because I had the wrong expectations. I expected that doing this would take away my urges to binge on those foods, and this expectation was definitely perpetuated by my therapist. Since I didn't know how to deal with the urges to binge, I still binged on those foods. Today, eating former binge foods in moderation is completely effortless because my urges to binge are gone. There is nothing about sugar or fat that makes me lose control and eat dozens of cookies, nor was there ever. It was my choice all along. I just didn't know how to say no. Although I did allow myself to eat former binge foods that I liked, there were some that I had no desire to eat in any amount. Sticky buns and Twinkies come to mind. Many of the foods I binged on, I truly didn't want. Only when my lower brain was in control did I feel the irrational need for the unhealthiest of foods. After I stopped binge eating, I felt no need to incorporate those foods into my diet. When I was bulimic, I used to think that nearly every craving for a pleasurable food was a disguised craving for a binge. However, after my recovery, I learned that there is a tremendous difference between an urge to binge and a craving for a pleasurable food. Everyone has food cravings and wants to indulge in pleasurable foods from time to time. I am no different. After my recovery, I learned that I faced the same choices as the rest of the population when I felt like indulging in a treat. Have the treat or don't have it. Have a small portion, a moderate amount, or overindulge a little. Whatever choices I made in regard to eating pleasurable foods, they didn't lead to binge eating. It wasn't long before I felt completely confident in having treats. A small cookie, or five. A piece of birthday cake, or two. A small scoop of ice cream, or a large fudge sundae. A small order of fries, or a supersized portion, without it getting out of control. I also felt confident in sometimes saying no to those sugary and fattening foods. knowing that I wouldn't go home later and eat the entire box of cookies. This is because I learned that, regardless of when my urges to binge popped up, whether it was while eating a cookie or a salad, I could easily recognize them and choose not to act. Legalizing binge foods. Traditional therapy and self-help books for binge eaters often recommend learning to eat former binge foods in moderation. The exception is addiction therapy, which recommends complete abstinence from problem foods. Legalizing foods is an especially important part of cognitive behavioral therapy. As discussed above, I believe legalizing foods can certainly help the urges to binge subside after binge eating stops, because it deconditions the brain so that the former binge foods no longer create urges to binge. Legalizing sometimes doesn't appeal to people with eating disorders, because many of them are, ironically, extremely health conscious. That is, their highest human brains are health conscious, while their lower brains are running on programs that are health sabotaging. They may honestly not want any former binge foods in any amount, because they know that those sugary and fattening foods aren't good for their health. If you are one of those people, don't feel you have to put sugary, fatty, and often chemical-laden food into your body in the name of recovery. Just as it's not necessary to avoid your former binge foods, it's not necessary to eat them either. If you decide to avoid all former binge foods, you only have to remember that if and when you decide to eat a former binge food, which you most likely will at some point in your life, expect that your lower brain may produce an urge to binge. It may automatically fire up some old patterns of neural activity, but as long as you know how to put brain over binge, this shouldn't bother you at all. Meal plans. Just because I didn't choose to follow a meal plan when I stopped binge eating doesn't mean I don't think they can be useful for others. After a bulimic stops binge eating, if she feels she can't eat normally without the guidance of a meal plan, then by all means, she should use one. There is no special formula for a correct meal plan, as long as it provides adequate nutrition. Individuals can create custom meal plans for themselves by doing some research into healthy diets, or they can consult a nutritionist or dietitian to educate them and help them develop a plan that will meet particular needs. Even those without eating disorders use meal plans sometimes to make sure their bodies are properly nourished. Having said all this, there are some things to keep in mind in order to use a meal plan effectively. First and foremost, it won't make urges to binge go away. Rather, meal plans help people eat normally despite their urges to binge. The urges that will inevitably arise signal only automatic faulty brain activity, not an ineffective meal plan. Of course, the goal is to eventually get off the meal plan and have freedom to eat what and when you want, as long as there is no binging. Conversely, not being on any type of food regimen after binge eating stops might be the preference. The lower brain may react to a meal plan as it would react to a diet, becoming extremely defensive and sending out powerful cravings for more and more food. Also, meal plans can require a lot of advanced preparation and thus create unnecessary stress, again devoting too much attention to food and eating it when it would be better directed elsewhere. So if meal plans are just not for you, trust yourself and don't worry so much about what and when you eat. It really doesn't matter as long as urges to binge are recognized but not followed. Chapter 32. Body image, weight, and dieting. I don't remember ever liking my body. In my mind, there was always something wrong with it. And even now, I don't necessarily like my body, although it's definitely easier to live in when it's not bloated from all the binging. While I was in therapy, I thought I needed to cure my poor body image in order to recover. Yet everywhere I looked, I saw women who had poor body images, just like me, who supposedly didn't have eating disorders. Just as I thought all my friends, co-workers, and family members with food issues had eating disorders, I believe that everyone I met with a poor body image had a potential eating disorder as well. but they did not. Poor body image is in no way unique to women with eating disorders. Poor body image doesn't cause or maintain bulimia, and developing a good body image is not a cure for bulimia. Body image is predominantly a cultural problem. The majority of women in American society, and many men for that matter, have some hang-ups about their bodies and have some physical features they wish they could change. In fact, the National Eating Disorders Association reported that 80% of American women are not satisfied with their bodies. In one study, 74.5% of women aged 25 to 45 reported that their concerns about shape and weight interfered with their happiness. However, only a small fraction of American women have eating disorders, about 1 to 3%. Body image concerns are merely one reason that some people may begin dieting. And for a small percentage, due to many factors, including biology, genetics, and personality, diets become problematic. Dieting and the accompanying brain changes that can cause eating disorders. Regardless of what sparks the dieting, be that poor body image or another issue. I'm sure poor body image played into my decision to diet. It is possible, of course, that loving my body as a teenager could have prevented me from dieting in the first place and therefore prevented my bulimia. But once my dieting led to a survival reaction and binge eating, any concerns I had about my looks or weight didn't maintain my habit. The lower brain did that. It didn't matter if I wanted to be thin, fat, tall, short, stocky, muscular, or curvy, I continued having urges to binge. Around the end of my sophomore year of college, about 4 years before I recovered, I more or less gave up on the idea of having a perfect body. I tried to accept my body for what it was. However, this was extremely difficult as the pounds piled on due to my binge eating. Often it seemed like all the self-affirmation in the world wouldn't have been enough to convince me to like my body while I was ruining it with bulimia. And even when I did have a decent body image and felt okay with my weight, I still had urges to binge, and I still binged. No amount of acceptance or love of my body could reverse my habit. After I stopped binge eating for good, I learned that, as far as recovery goes, it simply wasn't necessary for me to be able to stand in front of the mirror and like what I saw. In fact, it's not even necessary for me to like my body in order to have a full life. Sure, feeling confident in my appearance can be beneficial in some ways, but the body is ever aging and changing. Good looks are at best fleeting, and it doesn't make much sense to get hung up on those things when there are so many more important things in life. After I recovered, I found that I had no desire to diet or lose weight. Nearly all of my harmful thoughts concerning body weight and diet went away. It seems that any weight concerns I had were amplified as long as I was binge eating. It took about 5 or 6 months after I stopped for my body to level off to a normal and healthy weight for my particular body type. Now, if I gain a little weight, which I certainly have done with 3 pregnancies, that's fine. And if I lose a little weight, which I have done trying to keep up with my small children, that's fine too, as long as I still feel healthy. I find it ironic that my weight is basically the same now as it was before I started dieting in high school. That's such a testament to the inefficacy and harmful nature of dieting. Instead of leaving my body alone and maintaining my healthy weight, I lost 30 pounds by dieting, gained over 50 by binge eating, and then lost 20 after recovery. This was a total of 100 pounds of unnecessary weight fluctuation, all to land me back at the same weight where I'd begun. I hope my story can motivate some young people to stop restrictive dieting because it simply doesn't work in the long run. Giving up dieting. I know now that it's simply not worth it to obsess about food and weight. Maybe that's wisdom that comes with age, or maybe it's just because I've seen how much trouble dieting caused my body and brain. Some might say that my new attitudes about food and weight are the real cure for my bulimia. However, this would be inaccurate. Throughout most of my years of binge eating, aside from the first year, I truly wanted to eat healthy, exercise moderately, and let my body settle to its natural weight. But binge eating got in the way. Even when I completely gave up dieting during those years, it did nothing to get rid of the urges programmed into my brain. Some might say that my new beliefs and attitudes about food and weight, if not the cure for my bulimia itself, are what prevented me from relapsing. This would also be untrue. Regardless of my eating and exercise habits or body image, I will never relapse because, as I've said, relapse